Ladies and gentlemen, we have one case for argument this afternoon, CFTC and Lakeshore Asset Management. Mr. Nissen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me, I've got a sore throat, and I hope my voice holds out. May it please the Court, my name is William Nissen on behalf of Defendant Lakeshore Asset Management Limited. This case presents two very important jurisdictional issues of widespread importance, which I plan to discuss. Number one, what is the power of the federal government to seize private property? And number two, what is the power of the federal government to regulate business activities that take place outside the United States? On October 15th, this court issued an order denying a stay in a later appeal arising from this same case. And as I read that order, it rejects some of the arguments we're making in this appeal, but it was under a likelihood of success standard, and I do plan to address those issues and attempt to persuade the court to take a different view on a final decision from what was in that October 15th order. And I would like to emphasize that these issues are fundamental jurisdictional and due process issues we're raising, and it's their resolution, we believe, will have an impact on other cases. First, I'd like to just distinguish between the different Lakeshore companies, Your Honor, because I think there's a distinction between Lakeshore Limited, whom we represent, and some of the others who are involved in this case. Lakeshore Limited is a Bermuda corporation with an office in Chicago, formed in September 2006, registered with the CFTC in January 2007, and accepted its one and only U.S. investor in May of 2007. It is not in itself an investment fund. It holds no money for investors. It owns no brokerage or bank accounts, has no power to dispose of funds in any of those accounts. And the evidence and the findings of the district court show it to be an investment manager and advisor, which identifies and makes investments for the investment funds. The other Lakeshore companies involved, on the other hand, are themselves investment funds. They're separately incorporated. A number of them are sketched out on the last page of the district court's order. And these investment funds do own and control accounts where investor money is kept. They are all incorporated in foreign countries and offered their investments only to persons outside the United States. And the one fund for which there's an offering memo in the record shows that this fund is a British Virgin Islands fund that is regulated by the Financial Services Commission of the British Virgin Islands. And so I think there's a distinction here in that the Lakeshore Asset Limited, which is the investment advisor or manager, is a CFTC registrant, but the funds themselves, in particular the one whose memo is in the record, is regulated by the Financial Services Commission of the British Virgin Islands. Now, none of these investment funds is named as a party to this case. However, the injunction is issued directly against them in the sense that it uses the term Lakeshore Common Enterprise as what the injunction is issued against. And and it potentially prevents them from dealing with their own assets, which are at brokerage firms in England. And the common enterprise theory or term has been used in the case law in the past only to denote joint and several liability on behalf of parties to the case. And we know no precedent where it's been used in this way to enjoin non-parties. The rationale that the
What difference does it make whether the district court expressed it this way or just issued an injunction against Lakeshore Asset Management Limited, and the scope of the injunction is then given by Rule 65D to include all people who are acting in concert with the defendant?
Your Honor, there's a big difference.
Let me tell you why I can't see the difference. The district court found as a fact that the other Lakeshore entities were acting in concert with Lakeshore Asset Management. And therefore, one would think, given Rule 65D, you put two and two together, the injunction is binding on them. There's nothing. So what's the difference? That's the source of my query.
I understand, Your Honor, and I do have an answer for that. The Zenith versus Hazeltine case addressed the Supreme Court case, which was, in fact, affirming, in that respect, the decision from this court addresses that very question. In that case, there was a parent-subsidiary relationship. The subsidiary was the party to the case. The parent was the non-party. The district court entered an injunction against both the parent and subsidiary, and this court vacated the injunction against the parent, and it addressed that rule. And in that case, there was actually a stipulation that one was the alter ego of the other. The Supreme Court specifically addressed the Rule 65D issue. What it said was that anybody who's alleged to be in that Rule 65D language, active concert, participation, and so forth, deserves their own day in court and has to have their own day in court. And so the way it works under Zenith versus Hazeltine is the injunction is entered against the party, and then if a non-party assists the party in violating the injunction, that non-party has to be brought into court and given its day in court as to whether or not it was an active concert or participation the party.
So your argument, in other words, is that the Lakeshore entities other than Asset Management Limited have never been served with process.
Correct. And they've also not been named as parties, Your Honor. So neither one has happened. They're not parties to the case.
I don't care much whether they're named as parties, because if there's an enforcement proceeding under Rule 65D, they'll be brought in without necessarily being parties in the underlying lawsuit. You can be in contempt of an order about which you know and have actual notice, even if you aren't formally a party. That's the point of Rule 65D.
Right, and that's consistent with Zenith versus Hazeltine, Your Honor. That's exactly what that case holds, but they have to be brought in is the point on a contempt proceeding, and then at that point it has to be proven against them in a party in a proceeding that they're a party to that they are acting in contempt and that they are actively participating.
Well, that hasn't happened here, has it?
Hasn't happened?
They have not been held in contempt?
They have not, no, Your Honor.
Well, isn't it requisite for your complaint for them to be held in contempt or brought in and refused a hearing or something?
Correct. You would never bring that other party unless there were a contempt, exactly.
Right.
Or if they were accused of the contempt right. of helping the party, exactly.
Then they're entitled to hearing.
Then they're entitled to hearing on that issue. Have they actively participated or acted in concert? It would be a clear break with settled law, and we believe a dangerous precedent in many contexts if this court were to hold otherwise, that a court can obtain jurisdiction over one party and then adjudicate the rights of an absent party merely by finding that the two are engaged in the common enterprise. I'd like to address now the extraterritorial application of the Commodity Exchange Act, which is...
Before we get there, let me raise something that I found puzzling in your brief. I would have supposed that the initial question is just a question about the meaning of the statute, Commodity Exchange Act's provision for record keeping and record disclosure in Section 6N, paren 3, paren A. And your brief seems to be at a much different level of generality. You're not analyzing the statutory language and making a statutory argument. Is there a statutory argument to be made here?
On the record-keeping requirement, Your Honor?
Well, both keeping and disclosure.
We really haven't addressed that. I mean, we've really addressed the jurisdictional. I don't
even comprehend what you're referring to as a jurisdictional argument. The district court has jurisdiction because this is a suit by an agency of the United States, and jurisdiction is provided by federal statute.
Right.
That leaves a question about the meaning of the statute.
Right.
There's no question of jurisdiction here. There's subject matter jurisdiction and there's personal jurisdiction because Lakeshore Asset Management has been served with process and it's amenable to process. So the only question is, what's the meaning of the statute?
Well, I think there's a question as to the scope of the statute, and that's what I refer to as the courts have typically referred to the scope of the statute as subject matter jurisdiction.
No, it doesn't. Subject matter jurisdiction has to do with the adjudicatory competence of the tribunal. And there is no question whatsoever that the district court is competent to resolve this dispute. The only question is, what decision should it give on the merits? It's a question of statutory, normal statutory interpretation.
But I think one of the issues on the statute is how far does it apply in extraterritorial activities, and that's what I was going to go into, Your Honor, because the general rule is the statutes stop at the borders of the United States, but under certain circumstances they can be applied outside the borders, and that's the extraterritorial issue. And the
as I say, I'm just completely lost. The only defendant in this case is a registered entity.
That's correct.
Right? So there's no question this entity has to obey the statute. The only question is, what does the statute mean? I don't see how we ever get beyond that.
Well, my argument would be that you would talk about where does the statute apply. In other words, it does.
It applies to the defendant, which is a right. registered commodities right. advisor.
Correct, Your Honor. It does apply to the defendant, but if the defendant is acting outside the jurisdiction, for example, a
Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith sells securities someplace else, and it's a registered advisor, then it has to comply with the statute. That's what goes with the territory of registration. And we then need to figure out what the statute means. It's quite possible for Congress to pass a statute saying Merrill Lynch has to report on all of its transactions anywhere in the world, or Merrill Lynch has to report on its transactions in the United States. I just need to know which way this statute is written.
Well, I understand what the court's saying, and that isn't our argument, Your Honor. Our argument really has to do with...
If your argument isn't about the meaning of the statute, it seems to me it's just no argument. One can't argue about jurisdiction in the abstract. You know, the Supreme Court says we don't presume extraterritorial application of statutes. That's fine. But we still then need to figure out the meaning of the actual statute.
And, well, I guess what I would like to talk about the jurisdiction over the fraud claim that's alleged here, Your Honor, in terms of extraterritoriality. That is, I think, the issue here in terms of whether or not the statute applies to the conduct that has occurred outside the United States. And the crux of this complaint has to do with the relationship between foreign investors and foreign investment funds. And that's what the court has adjudicated. The court has been adjudicating issues pertaining to these other foreign investment funds, as we indicated, the only one of which...
Is there any problem with the proposition that if a registered U.S. commodities advisor helps somebody abroad commit a fraud in a foreign country, that the CFTC can drop a ton of bricks on his head?
I think there is a question, Your Honor, because I believe the...
Why?
Why? Because the...
Why are you entitled to remain a registered commodity advisor in the United States if your business includes committing fraud anywhere in the world?
Well, because people often have multiple registrations, Your Honor. They may be registered in many different countries, and then you would have to look at what activity are they engaged in. Is it within the scope of that registration? And, for example, we cited that New York Currency Research case, which said that even though someone is registered, if they're not acting within the scope of that registration, then they don't have obligations to the CFTC. And that's really our argument, is that they're not acting within the scope of the registration when they're dealing outside the country with foreign investors. And that's,
why did they register in the first place?
People register so that they can deal with residents of the country in which they're registered. That's the typical thing. And so you might be registered in several countries. When you deal with the residents of one country,
CFTC's position, as I understand it, is that Lakeshore registered in the United States, first, to effect trades in the United States, and second, so that this group of companies could advertise itself as regulated in the United States and therefore more trustworthy. And it does seem very bad to register for that purpose and then say, and oh, by the way, if we turn out not to be trustworthy, the registration authorities in the United States can't do anything about it.
Well, I would disagree with that being what the requisite for registration is. The requisite for registration is being able to offer products to U.S. investors. And that's really what it has to do with. You can approach the U.S. public and sell them funds under this registration.
That's right. I think you have to be registered in the United States if you provide investment advice in the United States, even if that's going to lead to trading in London.
That's correct, Your Honor. But by the same token, you can be outside the United States and offer advice to a foreign client concerning U.S. markets, and you're not required to be registered, because that advice and that relationship takes place outside the United States. And it's only if you have to either be in the U.S. Giving advice, or outside the U.S. but giving advice to someone in the U.S. that would be subject you to the registration requirement. There are many advisors and many funds outside the U.S. that are dealing in the U.S. markets, but as long as they deal only with foreign investors, they're not required to be registered in the United States. And that's really the hallmark. Are you dealing with the residents of that jurisdiction? And the offering of the interest by the funds to the investors, we believe under this court's Kowthar case, would be outside the scope of U.S. jurisdiction. Under Kowthar, it was an Indiana corporation. Thank you, Your Honor. If I might save my time for rebuttal and
certainly, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
Mr. White.
May it please the Court, I am Martin White, representing the CFTC, and starting in with a preliminary injunction, I guess it hardly needs saying that the Commission agrees with substantially the analysis that you've at least put out for discussion so far.
Well, but was it the Commission that asked that the injunction name as respondents people who have never been served with process?
Yes. And
why didn't you ask the district court to do what Rule 65 says? It may be six of one, half a dozen of the other, but much of what law is the preservation of forms.
Well, let me give you two answers. One is, it was our understanding that our actions in setting up the amended complaint were, in fact, giving actual notice to the other parties involved, Mr. Baker, and
this is litigation. You serve people with process. Notice happens in a very particular stylized form.
Right.
And notice to a foreign party, of course, is subject to very special rules that the diplomats have negotiated. Why didn't you do that?
Well, we have been, to the extent that we can identify agents of these individuals who are somewhat hard to find, we have, in fact, been serving them. And I think at this point we would at least argue, I'm not sure Judge Manning has ruled on it, that we have, in fact, effected service on the larger organization, Lakeshore Asset Management Group, Mr. Baker.
Normally, service of process precedes the entry of a judgment.
Yes.
It doesn't follow the entry of a judgment.
Well, on the other hand, Rule 65, I guess because of the preliminary nature of a preliminary injunction, speaks to notice, not service. And as I say, we have been trying. It's at least arguably that by now we have effectuated it.
Let me try this one more way.
Yeah.
Do you have any problem with the proposition that the district court's judgment should be reversed to the extent the injunction is issued against people who were never served with process and who never entered appearances in the litigation?
I think it would, well, at a minimum, the injunction is effective against people of that sort who collaborate with Lakeshore.
Would you address my question?
Yeah.
Have any problem with thinking or with our doing reversing the district court's judgment to the extent it names people who have never been served with process and who never entered an appearance in this litigation? Then the injunction would name Lakeshore Asset Management Limited, and by virtue of Rule 65D, it would be binding on all inactive concert who have actual notice.
I think that would be a satisfactory result, though not the optimal result.
What do you mean not the optimal result? It looks to me like the only legal result, right? In a place that follows rules of law about who gets service and what injunctions look like and who's bound by them, you say you can't enjoin people who are never served with process, but you've got Rule 65D.
Well, as I understand Rule 65D, the notice provision allows you to get the injunction effective as to them as a preliminary matter while you are tracking them down. However, again, I'll certainly agree that you can get the practical result through a different route. And with respect to...
As I discussed with Mr. Nissen, the parties have regretfully never discussed the meaning of the governing statute. But what is the CFTC's understanding about the meaning of 6N3A?
6N3A. Well, I think I'd like to start out with the definition of commodity trading advisor, rather commodity pool operator, which, of course, 6N3A hinges on.
Yeah.
And that's in Section 1A, in the definition section 1A5, and it refers, commodity pool operator refers to any person engaged in a business, the nature of an investment trust, syndicate, et cetera, that involves pooling money to trade on contract markets. So I think what that language means is any person, wherever in the world to start with, who is putting together commodity pools to trade on U.S. markets. Okay, now turning to 4N, or rather 7 U.S.C. Section 6N, Commodity Exchange Act, Section 4N3A, you have to be a commodity trading advisor or commodity pool operator. Those are defined potentially to include anyone in the world as long as their business is trading on U.S. markets. Okay, you have to be registered under this act. And so once you have, you're in the business of putting together pools to trade on U.S. markets, you're registered in the U.S. So those are the two requirements. And once you meet those requirements, it says you shall maintain, you have to comply with the requirements of the Act. You have to maintain books and records, and you have to make them available to the Justice Department and the CFTC. And I think that's what the statute says pretty squarely. Now,
How does this argument square with the Supreme Court's frequently expressed view that Congress does not regulate the foreign activities, even of firms in the U.S., without saying so? So if you're a U.S. employer and you're covered by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, but you have a branch in Saudi Arabia and Saudi law says you can't employ women, is it a violation of U.S. law not to employ women in Saudi Arabia? And as you know, the Supreme Court has said no, it's not, because although Congress has said we're regulating everything employers do, it hasn't clearly attempted to make that applicable to your overseas activities. Is there anything clearer in 3A than in Title VII about regulating overseas activities?
Let me make, I think I have 3 points in response to that. The first is, unlike your employees in Saudi Arabia, at least potentially, the very business here is the whole business we're talking about, even though it involves foreign customers, is trading on U.S. markets under the banner of a U.S. registration. So within the statute itself, we have that hook.
Maybe my question just isn't clear. To the extent trading occurs in the United States, there's no problem. To the extent advice is given in the United States, all the books concerning that advice have to be open. The thing that bugs me is what happens if a U.S. registered advisor, properly registered, gives advice which says, I recommend that on the London Metals Exchange you do the following things, where you is another firm and everybody who's involved is a, you know, make it simple, lives in London, and in fact that trade is executed on the London Exchange. Is there anything in this act which says the CFTC is entitled to the details of that trade executed on the London Metals Exchange?
I'm going to first, again, I'm going to have to give you two answers. The first answer is that Judge Manning, in the preliminary injunction order that is now
before the court. There's nothing in that statute about Judge Manning.
What?
There's nothing in that statute about Judge Manning.
Yes, however, Judge Manning had your question in mind because she...
If you were very clever, you wouldn't interrupt him.
Okay.
Just leave it.
Forgive me, yeah. The terms of the preliminary injunction we're now considering, I believe, limited it to records of being a commodity trading advisor or commodity pool operator, I think within the meaning of the statute, or to trading on the U.S. So the order that is before us is structured so you do not have to reach the ultimate question you're posing. That's my first answer. And the second answer, I guess, would depend on whether there's in fact some sort of connection. I think we'd have to fall back on cases like Tamari and Kothar, which I think are intended as a kind of.
I'm not asking about what Judge Manning did.
Yeah.
I'm not asking about what this court said 30 years ago in Tamari. I'm asking about the meaning of this statute. What is the CFTC's understanding of the meaning of this statute?
Standing here on one foot, I think the most plausible reading is books and records that relate reasonably to trading on U.S. markets.
Is that the commission's position, or is it? Or are you winging it?
To my knowledge, the commission has not specifically addressed that, but I don't want to, you know, I might go home and have a different answer for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
In any case, under the approach to the statute that I guess we've arrived at, in this case, again, you are not close to the outer limits of what the statute covers, because you have, while many of the, we actually don't have, given the lack of cooperation in from Lakeshore, we don't have full information, but presumably at least many of the customers are overseas, but much of the trading is heavily involved in U.S. markets. I think that's conceded. We have registration in the U.S. We have a conscious choice of a U.S. primary custodian, the Bank of New York, with all the money from whatever country flowing into this enterprise through the Bank of New York. We have, to the extent that we've been able to track funds at this point in time, most of the money is being held at a U.S. FCM, Sentinel Management Corp. If you look at the marketing materials and disclosure materials, in addition to touting the fact that the enterprise is subject to U.S. regulation, it goes out of its way to hype the fact that the money, except for the minority of the money that's being actively traded at any given time, is in fact being held in U.S. regulated entities. So the district court had very firm grounds, particularly at the standard of a preliminary injunction, for determining that the statute did cover the matter, the subject matter of her injunction. As far as the substantive merits of the injunction, there was also quite substantial evidence, particularly in light of the fact that we're at the preliminary injunction stage and the lack of cooperation from Lakeshore, that there was quite a history of fraud going on with respect to the nature of the trading, profits, et cetera.
How can one tell if you haven't seen the books and records?
Right. To the extent we've seen books and records, they are inconsistent. We've gotten trading records from the FCMs, and they are inconsistent with the advertised profits. So that's something like a prima facie case.
FCM, Futures Commission Merchant?
Futures Commission Merchant.
I actually know what an FCM is. I'm not clear that other people know.
Forgive me.
The fact that I teach derivatives regulation doesn't mean that all judges of the Seventh
Circuit. I've always avoided the subject myself very carefully.
Right, yes.
And I shall continue to do so as far as possible.
Even given the court you're sitting on. But in any case, given the preliminary stage of the proceeding, there's quite good evidence of fraud, and certainly enough to support a preliminary injunction. And there's also, again, I'll call it prima facie evidence or preliminary evidence that money is either missing or there are major discrepancies in how money is kept track of.
I wish to caution you briefly. Yeah. I am quite familiar with the laws of evidence, so you're not going to lose me on that one.
So yeah. I think the substantive basis for a preliminary injunction is very strong here. Turning briefly to the NFA action, I think the major point I'd like to highlight is that the National Futures Association, this self-regulatory organization operating with the approval of the CFTC.
What is the current status of the proceeding before the CFTC?
Before the CFTC, that is up to, basically nothing is happening at the choice of Lakeshore. The way the procedure works.
Excuse me. One would think that once a request has been filed before a federal agency, the choice about how to proceed is the agency's.
The procedure that is set up.
Giving away its power to regulate its own proceedings.
The procedure that is set up in the regulation as follows: the National Futures Association, finds reason to believe that some sort of summary action is needed, and at that point, the member subject to the summary action has one route approach and one side approach. The main route is to request a prompt evidentiary hearing in front of the National Futures Association, and then that would eventually go up to the CFTC and this court or whatever court. While the member subject to the action is either electing to pursue that route or not electing to pursue that route, the member can simultaneously go to the CFTC and ask for a stay of the action pending exhaustion of administrative remedies. But at the first step, all the procedures provide before the CFTC is a stay or no stay. The CFTC, on rather full briefing, denied a stay. The denial of the stay is now before this court, but whatever happens to the stay one way or another, the route to, if Lakeshore wishes to pursue the merits and show that the facts don't support the member action and so on and so forth, it needs to exhaust administrative remedies with a hearing in front of the NFA, at which the NFA, in fact, would have the burden of proof. So what the CFTC did is made a yes-no decision, in this case a no decision, on a stay of the effect of the member action pending normal exhaustion of administrative remedies. And the issue before this court in this appeal is whether the effect of the member responsibility action should be stayed pending normal exhaustion of remedies.
Actually, the first issue before us is an issue that neither side has paid any attention to, and it's a real jurisdictional question, which is whether the CFTC's denial of a stay is a final agency order subject to review. It turns out that we have addressed this very question not under Section 2LI4, the provision in the Commodities in the Futures Act, but the almost identical provision dealing with the SEC. And we held 29 years ago that when the SEC denies a stay under these circumstances of a self-regulatory organization's action, it is not judicially reviewable because it's not final agency action. You go, but your brief says that it is reviewable, and I can't for the life of me figure out why.
I may have made a mistake.
The Commodity Futures Act should not be treated the way the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 is treated? Is there some material difference?
I think what drove our position, and it is possible if I'd done more research, I would have reached a different conclusion, but I think what drove our position is the fairly dramatic practical effect of the member responsibility action in this case, which suggested that it might be the sort of situation in which an exception to exhaustion was appropriate, at least for the limited purposes of determining whether they obtained a stay.
The action in our decision, Allen, back in 1978, was yanking somebody's trading privileges, basically shutting down his business by the New York Stock Exchange, and the SEC refused to stay the Stock Exchange's decision. We held that that's not a final order and it's not judicially reviewable. Now, I can't see any difference between that and this situation, but it's possible the two sides have some.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to object if you decide that the cases are identical, and I should have pursued that more fully.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. White. Anything further, Mr. Nissen?
I'd just like to address a few of the points that have been made during Mr. White's argument. First of all, I think on the injunction in terms of the idea of having it against the defendant and then by virtue of Rule 65D against others, binding on the others as well, I do think it's potentially a different injunction in that I think that is a different injunction from the one that was entered, because I think the one that was entered directly precludes those other entities from dealing with their own property, whereas the new injunction would only preclude them from dealing with their own property if acting in concert.
But is there any doubt that they are acting in concert? You know, the Asset Management Limited, the real defendant in this case, is operating as an investment advisor or a commodity pool operator. And I don't imagine how one could argue that the advisees are not acting in concert with the advisor.
Well, but its business has been shut down, and so it's not doing anything now. That's the problem there. So I can't say in the future it would be acting in concert, because it's basically been driven out of business. I would like to address the books and records, too, the issue there. I think the issue there, what's happened in this case, again, this defendant has been made responsible for, it seems, for everything that every other company is doing. And from a books and records standpoint, again, this company's whatever obligations it has should only be this company's obligations. So if it is advising a fund, the fund is its client, and the fund's clients are not its clients. The fund is its client, and that should be the extent of the record-keeping obligation, not the clients of the client.
Is this assertion based on anything? What the statute says is that you have to keep and turn over books and records as required by the rules and regulations of the commission. And then you go back, the commission's got rules and regulations. Is the distinction you're drawn based on the CFTC's rules and regulations?
Only in the sense that it only applies to the registrant. The funds are not registered. The funds are foreign companies that are not registered. So their records are not subject to that. That's the extent to which it's based on the statute.
But is your argument based on what the regulations say or what you wish the regulations said?
I don't think the regulations address that, only in the sense that only the they address it only in the sense that the registrant is required to have certain things, but it doesn't require the registrant to have records of other entities, which is how far this injunction reaches. It requires this registrant to produce books and records of other registrants. It directs the members of this common enterprise to bring in their records.
Skip the foreign affairs question. I mean, just suppose that somebody asks Vanguard Management, the management company for the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds, for their books and records for any commodities trading that's being done. And you apply the regulations of the CFTC as written. What does Vanguard's management company have to turn over? Its own books or the books or also the books for the underlying funds? Just as a matter of the application of the CFTC's regulations. What does Vanguard do?
I would say only its own books.
Is that based on your interpretation of the regulations? And if so, which language in the regulations?
Because a registrant is required to...
Look, you answer a question about the language of the regulations by pointing me to something in the language of the regulations. This is why I'm kind of frustrated. A statute points me to the regulations. We go to the regulations. We try to figure out what they do. You can't answer a question about the contents of the regulations on a basis of first principles.
I see my time is up, unless the court has further questions.
It's called escaping.
Well, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.